How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a world-renowned rock, R&B, and hip-hop drummer who is widely referred to as the Minister of Groove. He has spent over four decades performing with many music superstars, including Lenny Kravitz, New Edition, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, Bobby Brown, Sean Lennon, Lisa Marie Presley, French superstar Vanessa Paradis, and Philip Bailey of Earth, Wind & Fire. He's been voted the number one R&B drummer in the world numerous times by Modern Drummer Magazine and Drum Magazine. He's also a highly accomplished author of four books about music: The Commandments of R&B Drumming, The Commandments of Early Rhythm and Blues Drumming, The Big Gig, Big Picture Thinking for Success, and The Commandments of the Halftime Shuffle. In addition, he is an immensely influential and inspirational educator and motivator with a passion for helping people achieve their potential and attain success. He's the author of a highly popular book entitled Soar, 9 Proven Keys for Unlocking Your Limitless Potential. And today, he's here to talk about his brand new book, which I absolutely loved, entitled Maria's Scarf, a memoir of a mother's love, a son's perseverance, and dreaming big. This is an incredibly heartfelt and heart-wrenching autobiography chronicling our guest's tumultuous journey as the fatherless, biracial child of a Mexican immigrant single mother who somehow managed to raise her 7 children in an atmosphere of love, courage, faith, tenacity, and optimism. From the impoverished and notorious streets of Compton in South Central Los Angeles to the harsh realities of rural Oregon, this is a man who, thanks to his mother's many sacrifices and unbreakable resilience, overcame countless, almost insurmountable obstacles of abject poverty, racism, and adversity. He was an insecure little boy who grew up longing for the love and approval of an absent father and struggling with identity, self-worth, and craving a sense of belonging. Thanks to the love and guidance of his mother and the unshakable bonds that kept his family together, he ultimately harnessed and channeled his pain, anguish, and ambition, together with his love of music and rhythm, to become one of the world's most successful and respected drummers. This book is so poignant, so uplifting and inspirational that I just had to invite the author, Zorro, to our show. Zorro, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, what an honor and what an incredibly wonderful, poignant introduction. I just feel blessed to be on your show, man, and I was honored that you actually read the entire book, and I could see that it touched you. That's awesome.
Well, that would be an understatement. You are the 5th of 7 children born to Maria Islas Bravo, a Mexican immigrant, and you were the first in your family to be born in America. Your book is so riveting and emotionally captivating because it's a tribute to the triumph of the human spirit. Tell me what inspired you to write the book, Zorro.
Well, I have been wanting to write it most of my life, honestly. I would tell many of my childhood stories on the road when I was with, you know, Bobby Brown, New Edition, Lenny Kravitz. And every time I would share my stories, the guys in the band would go, "You have an amazing story. You've got to write a book one day. You need to have a movie about your life." So I was always encouraged as I shared the stories personally with people. And people ask me how long have I been working on the book. The inspiration was to... I'm 61, about to be 62 on June 13th. And at this age, you start thinking about what's the most important thing you can contribute to the world. What's the greatest gift I can give to the world from the journey that I've been on and what I've learned? I thought the greatest thing that I can leave behind is this story, because mankind lives off of story. That's how we find hope. That's how we make sense of life. We all read books that are from people that have long passed away, from centuries ago to thousands of years ago, you know? And so story is the one thing that trumps everything. It's what we need to keep going. And I was inspired by different stories in my life of growing up, and I figured people would be inspired by mine. I also made a promise to my mother that one day I'd write a book about your life and tell people about how amazing you were and what kind of a person you were. And she always cried when I would tell her that. And so I figured the book is my gift to the world to inspire people long after I'm gone. Those words will echo for as long as books are out there in either audio or physical or e-books or whatever, that words are powerful. And so that was my inspiration. And I've actually been working on it, honestly, like for 50 years, because I kept a diary from when I was 10 years old into my early 20s. So as you saw in the book, there are literal diary entries from the kid, my 10-year-old self, 14, 18, 21. So when I look back, I go, man, I've been penning this book really without knowing it like my whole life.
Tell us the story of why you called the book Maria's Scarf.
Oh, yes. Well, a few reasons. One, Maria was my mother's name, so I wanted her name in there somehow. Two is there's a significance to the scarf and why I wear the scarf and where that came from. And when I was 7 years old, I, you know, my mother was my only influence. Not only did I grow up with a single mother and my siblings, but I was very untraditional than most kids in that I didn't grow up with any other relatives. I didn't grow up with uncles or aunts or grandparents or cousins. None of those people were in my life. And so really the only thing I had was my mother and my siblings. So those take on a much larger role when there's no other family to be spread around, right? And so my mother was pretty much it. And even though she was, when I grew up, we were totally impoverished, she always carried herself with a lot of pride and dignity, and she always wore scarves and looked really nice. And yeah, I used to always go, "Oh, Mama, you look like a movie star." You know, she always looked elegant. You know, you wouldn't know she was poor by the way she carried herself. But I, inside of me at 7 years old, was a budding rock star who didn't know that he was going to be a musician. But there was something in me that wanted to pull that out. And so one day I asked her if I could wear her. She had an orange silk scarf on, and I said, "Can I wear your scarf for my school picture?" And she's like, "No, mijo, you can't wear my scarf. The boys will beat you up. You're in the United States. You're not in Mexico," you know? And so she tried to talk me out of it, but I still wanted to wear it because I just wanted to look different. And then I convinced her. I said, "You know, well, Elvis Presley wears a scarf, you know, this is the late 60s, and Tom Jones wears a scarf, you know." And I convinced her, and then she knelt down and she tied her orange silk scarf around my neck. And then she said, "One day, my precious son, you will do something phantasmical with your life." And that was the word she used. It was a mix of fantastic, amazing, and wonderful. And she just sort of created her own word, said, "You're going to do something phantasmical." And so that scarf sort of weaves through the whole story of the book, as you know. And it is really what sort of, it's like emblematic of her love and hope and expectations for me. That scarf is like one generation passing hope to the next generation. And so it represents so many things. And I was looking for a title that was beautiful, poetic, and also mysterious. When you go, Maria's scarf, it makes you go, who's Maria? What's the scarf? And then you see the picture of the boy, me at seven, wearing the scarf. And then you see the mother wearing a scarf, and you want to know, what is this story? At least that's what my thought was. So that's where it comes from.
Now, you had an extremely challenging childhood, to say the least, Zorro. Because of extreme poverty, your mother had to move the family more than 30 times. And at one point, you were all living in a car. I want to read you something you wrote about that experience. You said, and I'm quoting you here, "While locals peered at us with disgust, I felt such shame. I ached for a normal life, or at least to be invisible. I wanted so badly not to have people look down on us, and I wished that fairy tales really could come true for people like us. But no amount of wishing seemed to make it so, and no amount of hard work either. Zorro, when you think back to that time in your life, were there any lessons or coping mechanisms that you acquired that have helped you later in life as an adult?
I think what I realized is that it's like somebody asked me this the other day. I'm going to be 62, and in my life, I'm not boasting in any way, but they were, you know, asking me, you know, how did you deal with partying on the road and stuff like that? And I told them the truth. I said, I've never been drunk or high in my entire life, and I'm almost 62. And I don't say that in any sort of arrogant, prideful, like I'm better than anybody. But I explained to them. I said, I think the reason why I never did any of those things is because I was so desperate in my childhood, and that the idea of spending $1 on anything that wasn't going to build my life seemed like a total waste to me. Because, like, as you know, the desperation of my childhood. So when I got older, any money that I made, I was dreaming about what I could purchase with it to better my life. Like, could I buy drum lessons with this? Could I buy drum books? Could I help my mother pay some bills? Could I buy myself a car? So all those things were practical. But I think, and the reason I didn't cave into the peer pressure as a teenager in junior high and high school is because I had none of those people liked me. So I learned to, with my mother and siblings, those were my friends, those were my people, those were my family. So I kind of found my identity within the love of my family and the approval of my mother. And then I didn't look for it in other places, which I think later in life gave me a strong identity in myself where I wasn't going to cave. I wasn't going to cave from anything. I wasn't going to cave from adversity. And one of the reasons, the thing that I think all that stuff helped me with the most as a musician, people that play with me, one of the things they say, and you kind of said it earlier with the writing of the book, like everything when people play with me, they go, you play with so much heart, you play with so much soul and so much passion. And people will say that about my writing or about whatever I do. And I go, I think that was the benefit of this childhood, is that everything mattered. And like when I do something, it's like my whole life depends on it. And I'm going to do my best, because I still won't know, you know, I may never know, like, would I have been this passionate had I not had that upbringing? Or was I born? It could be half and half, you know. Later in life, I also realized I'm half Mexican and half Irish. Although, you know, in the book, I don't really identify with either, because I'm not really enough of either culturally to really own that when I was a kid. But later in life, somebody once said to me, they said, oh, you're really a crazy passionate person. And they asked me what's my cultural background. And I told them, they said, well, that explains everything. I'm like, what do you mean? They go, well, Mexican people and Irish people are fiery people. They're so full of passion. And I never thought of myself as either. And sometimes when you grew up the way I did, you make up your own identity. It's not part of your cultural background, because I didn't speak Spanish. I wasn't born in Mexico City, and the Irish people in my family didn't want anything to do with me. So I didn't feel connected to either. But then I realized later, genes are very strong and they go through the centuries, and people, you know, have a propensity to be certain things because of this genetic code of centuries of people being like that. Right. So all of those things, but I guess the life lessons were that everything matters, and I'm going to overcome whatever I have to live out this dream. And that gave me audacity. That gave me tenacity. That gave me I've always been tenacious. And I think that's because of those desperate circumstances. And when I play the drums, it's like with all of my heart. And when I write, it's with all of my heart, you know, and that heart's going to bleed on the page.
Zorro, when your family moved from California to Oregon, you encountered quite a bit of racism and bullying. I mean, you had horrible rednecks living next door to you. They shot two of your dogs. Tell me about the racism and the bullying that you encountered.
Well, it's interesting, because when I grew up in LA, which I grew up in Compton, you know, which is known as the urban jungle, the hood, it's funny, there as a kid, I didn't really experience racism. I didn't really know what that was. I grew up mostly around black people, but there were some Mexicans and a few white people too. But it was more diverse, you know. So when we moved up to rural Oregon, a little town of 13,000, it was a beautiful little place, but that's the first time I experienced people hating us for no obvious reason, no reason other than my mother's accent and the color of her skin. And I was sort of mystified and stupefied by that. And I would tell my mother, I'm like, how could people hate us? We didn't do anything to anybody. And they just didn't like us. They didn't want us there. And it was very hurtful to see. I could take more of the bullying myself, but when people would make fun of my mother for something, oh man, I'd want to just end them, you know, because like this is my mother. She's awesome. She's hardworking. She loves her children. Like what? She hasn't done anything to you guys. And my mother had a lot of class and a lot of culture and came from a very refined family. Even though I grew up dirt poor, abandoned by my father, she was the daughter of a Supreme Court justice, and so she grew up with dignity. And so now when I look back on it, I go, how the heck did she not? You know, it's harder to have gone from the top and then fall than to just always have had nothing, you know, because you don't know any better. And so I go, how did she maintain all that in that town where people literally killed our dogs because they didn't like us, you know? And so again, there's two ways you can turn out in that situation. You could either turn out to be a hater. Like a lot of times when you grow up in bad situations, whether it's abandonment or rejection or bullying, those situations shape you and you become the product of what you experience. You become those people later. Or you go the exact opposite, which was me. And then I took all of that pain and then I decided, you know, that one day when I become a father, I'm going to be a great father. My kids are never going to feel what I felt. And I'm going to be somebody who defends people, somebody who loves people, somebody who accepts people, somebody. I'm not going to let people feel what I felt. So it made me go the opposite. It actually worked to my benefit because my pain became my purpose. And that's why I became speaker and a motivator. I mean, I've spoken everywhere from San Quentin prison to the jungles of Ghana, Africa, to underprivileged schools of people, poor minorities. I mean, you name it, I've spoken there. But I guess the reason I have a heart for all those people is because I was an underdog, and so I know what they need to hear, and it's very sincere. It just comes from my heart, and I was lucky that in all of that stuff, somehow my mother had the wisdom to teach me to protect my heart so that I wouldn't get bitter, so that I wouldn't get jaded, so that I wouldn't become a hater. It's like that Martin Luther King quote about hate, you know, and only love can conquer hate, you know, and which is true, because if you give in to what they did to you and you want to do it back, then you've lost the most important battle of all, the battle of your soul, you know. And by keeping your soul pure and intact, there's a proverb my mother used to read me from the Old Testament. The proverb said, above all else, guard your heart, for from it springs forth all of the issues of life. So every issue you deal with in your life is an issue of your heart. Jealousy, bitterness, rage, envy, anger, anxiety, everything is a heart issue. So it's learning how to protect that heart. And I'm still, believe it or not, almost 62, and I'm still the same kid on the cover of the book. I still have that childlike wonder, that faith. My next vision and dream that I've been working on for years is to turn my book into a movie and a Netflix series. You know, and that's been the vision all along, this story to become like a film.
Oh, it'll happen. It'll happen. I want to ask you about your father, Daniel Christopher Donnelly. He was an Irish American, as you said. He was married to your mother, but when you were only 6 months old, he said he was going out to buy groceries and he never came back. He deserted the family. How would you describe the impact on you of growing up without a father?
I think I still live with that pain to this day. I don't think any of the wounds of our life or of our childhood ever really go away. I don't think they ever. I think we learn to walk with a limp, you know, whatever that thing was, whatever it was that happened to us. Some people are lucky that maybe they didn't have anything substantial or anything critical that happened to them. But, everybody has a few punches and blows here and there, but some people clearly have it worse than others. You look at people in war and they lost their whole families, right? So I think those wounds run deep. But again, I think I used all of that to the betterment of my life. I think I used it to go, I don't ever want people to feel what I. So it made me a real rallier, a real encourager, a real champion of other people. But there's also a part that also made it like where deep inside, I'm not sure that anybody really, really likes me just for me, because when you spend all of your, it's different. If my father died like in a war when I was little, then it would be a completely different outcome. I would have still missed him, but I wouldn't have been rejected by him. It's a different feeling. When you're a kid and you're sending letters to your father all the time through the grandmother, because I never met him, and he never responds to any of them. And then you send your pictures and you send your report cards and you're doing everything you can to win his love. You don't understand this as a kid, but what it's making you feel is like nothing you do is good enough.
Well, you
Nothing.
did meet your father eventually several
Yes.
times.
Well, when I
And
was.
but did he ever tell you why he never responded to all those letters you wrote?
No, he was not a man who would share any of his feelings. I think when I like as I got to know him when I was a bit older, he's probably the most myopic man I've ever met, and he's just self-absorbed, and he's the kind of person that would just never take accountability and blame everything on something. The real truth of the matter is he married my mother to avoid being drafted in the Vietnam War, because at that time, if you were they took the single guys first, then the next would be the married guys. The last on the list would be married with children. So when he married my mother, who already had four children, he was instantly out. And I think once he sort of accomplished that mission, his brother talked him into leaving my mother and us. And so it left us in total dire straits. But I was young. I didn't know that yet, but it was as I was growing up, then I would learn about him, and I thought that I could win him over.
And
And
when
I
you did meet him,
yeah.
you didn't get the healing that you were hoping for, did you?
No, because what can possibly make up for 17 years of rejection in your formative years? Nothing. I mean, even if he became the nicest guy in the world, which didn't really happen, nothing. Your imprint has already been made. The damage has already been done. What do they say? Like before you're six or seven, like all the emotional stuff that's already happened to you has formed the imprint of who you're going to be, right? So if you take that and go all the way to 17, and you take all that rejection. So it's two things. The plus of all that was that it made me very strong, and it made me work hard. It made me hustle, because I'm like, hey, I got to make something of myself. And it made me have to prove myself to other people to be worthy of their love. I got to do something outstanding. I got to be the best drummer. I got to be the best writer. I got to be the best speaker. There's a part of that, but then on the other side, there's a more sorrowful part that you're so used to living that way that you think that if you don't pull out all of your greatness, that no one will actually really like you for you. And you're always trying to you wrestle between living in that space of accomplishing it for just accomplishment's sake, like for the I'm definitely a goal-oriented person. I'm a person who likes to do everything with a spirit of excellence. But then there's a part of me that goes like, well, if I don't, then people won't like me. Because I mean, growing up the way we did in Oregon, when everybody's like attacking you and no one is receiving you and no one is loving you, and in that way by society. I mean, there were a few people, that I mentioned in the book. So the town that I lived in, Grants Pass, was like any other town. Every town in the world is filled with good people and bad people. Every
But
town.
you know what? You mentioned there were two pluses.
Yeah.
I'm going to offer you a third plus. Has it ever occurred to you, Zorro, that if your father had not disappeared when you were a baby, if he had stayed with your mother and raised you, isn't it possible your life might not have turned out so well?
Oh, absolutely correct. I think about that all the time, because we are shaped by And here's the thing I learned. It was Larry King. He had a, him and Anderson Cooper, I had learned on some show they were on that they had both lost their fathers early or didn't have a good relationship. And they said a quote that totally resonated with me. And that's the first time I understood the power of being without a father. They said, "The fatherless child thinks that all things are possible and that nowhere is safe." The fatherless child thinks that all things are possible and that nowhere is safe. My, because I didn't have a father telling me how high or how low I could jump, the sky was the limit. Because sometimes a father, if he's like whatever, if he's a factory worker and comes from generations of factory workers and he doesn't have a vision for anything more, he might say, "Son, get yourself a job. You're dreaming to try to be a drummer." You know, like there's people who talk you out of your dream because of what happened to them. And I think that I know that my life wouldn't have turned out, and I wouldn't have turned out the kind of man I am with
Well,
his.
there's the thing. You're a father yourself of two beautiful children, Jared and Jordan. On June the 13th, 2012, you were honored at the White House for promoting responsible fatherhood as part of President Obama's Champions of Change initiative. Think about that. You broke the cycle and became the loving father for your children that you never had. That is the best form of gratification and healing you could
Yes,
ever have.
I think you're right, and you're the first one who's ever touched on all these really deep issues. And you're an amazing interviewer, and you've
Oh,
definitely.
I'm not done yet. You
You
know,
know, this is great.
as a young man, you legally changed your name from Danny Donnelly to Zorro. Tell us why you did that.
Well, part of it was when I got the gig with the New Edition, which was a big, huge group in the '80s. They were sort of the Jackson Five of the '80s. By then, I was already wearing a Zorro sort of bolero gaucho hat that my mother had got for me, and then she started saying, "Oh, you should call yourself Zorro because you're like the real Zorro. The real Zorro always had a heart for the underdog, right? He always fought for the commoner, and I always had that heart where I kind of had a heart for the underdog." So then I just when I got the gig with New Edition, I was already in sort of that taking on sort of the Spanish heritage of the hat and kind of trying to come up with a cool image or vibe to be different. And then they just started calling me Zorro, like themselves. They just were like, "Yo, Zorro, you know, do this on the hi-hat, psst, psst," you know, and they would just, and then when they would introduce me at the first concerts on stage, they would say everyone's name and they would say, his name's Danny, but we like to call him Zorro, you know. And then after the very first concert I did with them, all the fans backstage would come screaming at me and go, "Zorro, Zorro." They didn't remember my real name. They just remembered that they said Zorro. And that day I was like, "I'm going to become Zorro." And my mother was like, "You should call yourself Zorro, but spell it with one R to be different." And so it became more of a show business thing. But then later it also became like a way of cleaning the slate. Like I didn't want to give my children, my last name that my father never had any love for me. Like, why am I carrying on this man's name? He never cared for me, right? And the other thing that you touched on that was interesting, like, if I had been raised by my father, I wouldn't have had my mother's heart. And my mother, because you become a combination of both, my mother had this beautiful, tender, sentimental, loving, kind, affirming heart, which I was able to grab her heart without any interruption from a guy who could have altered that and made me completely different. And
You
so
know,
you.
I'm glad you removed his name from your identity because your father, quite frankly, did not deserve to have his name attached to yours. And I know everyone has called you Zorro for many years, but you know what I'm learning from our conversation?
What's that?
I think there are still times when you feel like Danny Donnelly.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm going to work on that with you, I tell you. You know, you wrote about two very special concerts that you attended as a child that inspired you to pursue a music career. And I'm going to ask you about both of them. The very first concert you ever saw was Diana Ross and the Supremes with the Temptations. What was the impact? If you can put it into words, can you articulate the impact on you of seeing those performers on that stage?
It was a transformation of soul power. Like the soul that was on that stage from those performers and those R&B rhythms and the drummer behind them, it was like a magnetic pull. You know, it's interesting because people always go like, what made you choose the drums or why the drums? I said, I didn't choose them. They chose me. I truly believe like the gifts that God gives us that we're born with, they're already in us. We're just discovering them at some point, but they've already been in there. They're in there the second you're born. So I had this rhythmic propensity and this draw to rhythm. All I had to do was be around it. And if you're around it, it's like a magnet. You know what I mean? You go, boom. And so that concert was electrifying because it pulled my soul to the soul of that groove and the soul of that music. And it instantly, like, this is what I want to do. But I was years away from actually doing it, but it
Well,
was.
but then you eventually had a full circle moment when you ended up playing drums with one of the members of the Temptations. That must
Oh.
have been an incredibly moving experience.
It was, and I've had so many of those. Like my favorite group as I got older was Earth, Wind, and Fire. They were just like they were it. They were everything. And I used to literally have daydreams. You know, when I was 16 or 17, I literally daydream and go, one day I'm going to be on a plane. I'm going to be sitting in first class. I'm going to be sitting next to Maurice White and Philip Bailey and Verdine White, and they're going to like me, and I'm going to be their friends. And you know, like I would just like entertain these delusions of grandeur. And then eventually all that stuff happened, and I've been their friends for 45 years. But all those full circle moments, they're why I wrote a story. They're incredible because it gives people hope, you know, that we're not just that dreams, you know, that are based in reality, meaning sometimes we dream of things that are not reality, meaning they're not even in our wheelhouse of potential to execute. But there are dreams that are based in reality, meaning like, you know, you might have had a dream of being a broadcaster. Well, you have a gift for it. You have a gift for that. And
Thank
so
you.
your gift is in alignment with your dream. You know, when it's not, it's a delusion. Like it's like somebody like the size of Shaq wanting to be a horse jockey. You can't be bigger than the horse.
Well,
You
let me
know.
go now to the second superstar that you got to see perform live in concert. It was Frank Sinatra on April 26, 1975, in Portland, Oregon. I want to read what you wrote about that experience. You said Frank's vocal prowess was astonishing. The tone and timbre were soothing to my soul, calming every agitation within me. Hearing him made me feel as if the fears and insecurities I carried would somehow vanish, and that everything would be all right as long as I kept listening to that voice. With each rising crescendo from the explosive horns and counter melodies, from the impassioned string section, the hair on my arms stood up. I had no way of processing what I was feeling. It seemed I had been touched by something otherworldly, something spiritual, something I couldn't understand, and I cried. Zorro, I want to tell you that when I read that paragraph in your book,
Yeah.
I sent it to my good friend Tina Sinatra, who recently appeared on our show, and she was so deeply touched that she called me and she cried. And she asked me to express her appreciation to you, which I am very happy to do right now.
Okay. This is gonna make me cry, man, because wow, man. You have no idea how much like Sinatra meant to me. And I had been trying to figure out a way to get my book to Tina Sinatra and
She's got it. She's got it.
I've had no way to get it to her. And it was a dream of mine to have Tina endorse the next iteration of the book, the next printing of the book, because I wanted her to know from a kid, that's from a kid, that's like a 12-year-old kid, of how that music touched my soul and how it still soothes my soul. I'm still the same 12-year-old that watched it. Having you tell me that you read that to Tina Sinatra and that she has or will be getting the book.
She has the book.
She has the book.
Oh, yes, she has the book. I sent her that paragraph that I just read to you. in an email, because we've become quite good friends since she was on our show. And she contacted me and said, I am getting that book. I've already ordered it. She has it. She's read it. And your dream came true. Sinatra's daughter loves you. Now, you know, you wrote something that really resonated with me, Zorro. You said, if necessity is the mother of invention, then surely desperation is the father of invention.
Yes.
So how many times would you say you've been truly desperate in your life?
Oh, countless times, countless times. I've lived in a state of desperation most of my life because, for instance, and I'm so thrilled that you love the book, that Tina, I would have never dreamed that Tina would even get the book or know about it, because I was like, I tried every avenue I could to get to her and I couldn't get an address. I couldn't get anything. And now it's there.
It's destiny.
Well, it's unbelievable is what it is. But everything I've done in my life, including writing this book, have been acts of faith where you, and I do things that I'm compelled to do. I've never done anything to like do it. I never wrote a drum book to like, oh, let me fill in a niche in the market so I can make money. But everything I did were passion projects, and everything I've done in my life, I have put my neck on the guillotine time and time again. For instance, this book, Maria Scarf, that's now touching hearts around the world, was rejected over 100 times. This was rejected in the last 15 years. I started pitching it 15 years ago, and it was always rejected by publishers saying, you know, he doesn't have 2 billion followers, da, da, da. Who is he? Nobody knows. The public doesn't know who he is. And I'm like, doesn't anybody see that a story trumps everything? The most, do you realize how many books wouldn't have got published 100 years ago that the classics, if people said, you know, that the you know, that Roald Dahl didn't have 1 million followers, and like, you know what I mean? Like, what about like the story is the most important thing in a book, but people are so I had to not give up the vision and the dream. And I rewrote this and worked on this over and over and over. Must've did 100 different proposals, rewrote the, I mean, like, oh, I mean, so I've always lived in this desperate place where I am, you know, most people would have given up everything I've tried to do. And they don't know this because they'll go, when the book came out, everybody who knows me or knows whatever, that I'm a world-renowned drummer, they'll go, well, he got the book deal because he's Zorro. Like, in their mind, they find this route that's not the true route of what it was. Everything that I've done, being a speaker, being a teacher, being a clinician, my drum, everything was just rejection, rejection, rejection. So here's the funny part. The whole story in the Maria Scarf is this overcoming story of this kid who has to deal with rejection and over in a band, all these things. So it's a story of overcoming, right? And you would think, okay, that's what the story is. But the story of the story coming to life is a continuation of that theme where for the last 15 years, I've had to overcome the rejections of different agents and the rejections of different publishers. And no one, interestingly enough, no one ever rejected it because they didn't think it was good. There are many times where I could see the acquisitions editor saying, I love this book, want to do this book. I'll be bringing it to the marketing group next week. Then when it got to the marketing table where there's 12 or 15 or 20 people that have to vote, that's where they turned it down because they lacked the vision of just seeing a great story for what a great story is. It so happened, and then other people turned it down. Other agents turned down representation because they said, there's not enough sex, drugs, rock and roll. We want to hear more dirt on Lenny Kravitz, Bobby Brown. And I'm like, that's not what this book is. This is a better book. This is a book that's going to touch hearts. This is the book that's going to inspire people. That other kind of book's trash. And no one will remember that 6 months later. But no one has forgotten these stories that I've told, the chicken stories and the sitting on the lawn at Beverly Hills High stories and all these stories that I've been sharing for years. No one ever forgets them.
In May 1978, you were just finishing grade 10. You got your first set of real drums instead of playing on an appliance box like you had been doing. Can you remember what it felt like to play on a real set of drums for the very first time?
It was like, you know, it's like one of those moments where the Cinderella's slipper fits. You know what I mean? It's like one of those moments where you're always out of sync. You've been wearing a bunch of shoes that don't fit you. You've been getting a bunch of hand-me-down shoes, too big, too small. And then one day somebody hands you a shoe that your foot just goes in it, and you're going like, "This is me. This is who I am." And it was like one of those kind of moments. It's like I always wore like Goodwill clothes from the Goodwill drop-off box, and it's like one day somebody gave you a tailored suit that was made to specifically to fit you, every measurement, and you're going, "Wow, I look amazing in clothes that fit," right? That's what it was like when I played the drums for the first time. It was like, this is who I am. This is, and I think I wrote something like that in the book, where, I was no longer the skinny kid. I was no longer the chicken farmer. I was no longer the half Mexican, half Irish kid who didn't fit in. I was now a drummer. I had found my identity.
You met your dear friend Lenny Kravitz in a very unusual way. You were pretending to be a student at Beverly Hills High School, where he was a student. What gave you the idea to do that?
A desperation. It was one of those things. I had just graduated high school in Eugene, Oregon. So I was 17. So, and I didn't really know where to meet people in LA. Like, I didn't know like where to meet kids my own age, because now I'm out of high school, but I don't really feel like a college kid because I'm not going to college. I didn't know where to meet people at UCLA. Like, it's such a big camp. Where would you stand to try to meet anybody? You're not going to school there. But I thought, well, the high school, I'm still kind of like a high school kid. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just go sit on the lawn and I'll do something audacious that demands attention. And so I brought my boom box, which I still have, that boom box, the very boom box. I'm going to use it in the movie one day. And I brought a practice pad and I was cranking Earth, Wind & Fire's Greatest Hits. And I thought, if I sit out on the lawn, and I was wearing a yellow silk shirt and yellow silk pants and a Panama Jack hat and some shades, and I go, there's no way they can miss me. If there's any musicians, they're going to go, "Who's this new kid?" And so I couldn't come up with any other idea. Like, how am I going to meet people, my age to try to play music with? And it wasn't like that I was trying to like run some sort of a con game. It was just more like, well, as soon as kids asked me, "Are you new there?" I just said, "Yeah," because I'm not supposed to be there. So I just kind of fell into this lie that I just started living, because I was like, "Well, if I'm not a student there, I shouldn't be there," right?
Well, you also met and befriended Berry Gordy's son, Kennedy, when you were hanging around Beverly Hills High. And through him, you got to meet the Jackson Five at Berry Gordy's house. Tell me about that experience.
It was unbelievable. So from that lawn experience, the two people that I met that changed the course of my life were Lenny Kravitz, and in fact, we're still friends to this day. I just left his 60th birthday party he invited me to in Paris. So we've been friends for 44 years, and we just had the best time, and he just celebrated that. Anyway, so and Kennedy Gordy was the other kid I met. And you got to understand, as a kid in the 60s, growing up in Compton and my family, we were all soul music lovers. So Motown was it for us. Every Motown artist was our favorite artist. We had all the 45s. So when I get driven up to Berry Gordy's house, I'm going, this is why I always say that I'm like the real life Forrest Gump. Like all these things happen to Forrest that should have never happened. He's at the White House with Elvis, and it's all these things. I'm like the real living Forrest Gump. Like, how did this kid who dug clothes out of a Goodwill drop-off box end up at Berry Gordy's mansion? And then one day, Michael Jackson and the Jackson Five. I have no idea, but I hear the doorbell ring. And I'm up there playing pinball with by myself, because Kennedy was in the shower, and he had pinball machines. You didn't have to pay to put money in his front yard, in his front living room. And so I heard the doorbell ring and playing the pinballs, and nobody's going to answer it. So I just decide to go answer the door, and I open the door, and it's Michael Jackson and the Jackson Five. I'm like, like, I'm just beside myself, because I belonged to the fan club. I was the biggest Jackson Five, and I'm looking at the real guys, and I immediately start trying to talk him into jamming with me. I'm like, "Michael, Jermaine, Tito, Jackie, Marlon." I said, "I know all your songs. I'm a drummer. I can play all your songs. And there's a music room, and Jermaine, there's a bass, and we can jam." And Michael goes, "Ah, kid, you got a lot of heart." And I end up talking to them for like 20 minutes while they were waiting for Berry Gordy to come down for a meeting. But it was just, and I wrote about it in my diary that night. And I wrote about it. I said, "No one will ever believe me, but I met my favorite group, the Jackson Five. I can't wait to tell Mama all about it."
Oh, what a story. Now, I know that Buddy Rich was one of your idols, and you finally got to meet him on Rodeo Drive. That must have been a dream come true.
That was probably the biggest of all of them. And the Jackson 5 was huge because just as a music group, they were my favorite. But as a drummer, Buddy Rich was the drum god. He was like what Tiger Woods is to golf or LeBron James is to basketball or whoever's the world's greatest at anything, Denzel or Robert De Niro to acting, Anyway, it was Buddy Rich was that. But when I This is all in the, all this happened in and around the same couple of few months of when I met those guys on the lawn at Beverly Hills High. And I was walking down Rodeo Boulevard on in Beverly Hills, and I see him. There he is, Buddy Rich. The was his title was the world's greatest drummer, and he lived up to it. And I went right up to him and stuck my hand out and I said, "Buddy Rich." And he goes, "Absolutely right." And I just looked at him all wide-eyed and I said, "My mother always said I would meet you one day." And he goes, "Moms are always right. Always listen to your mom, son." And then we got to talking, and he gave me his autograph. In fact, I'd love to get you a copy of the finished version of the book, so when we're done, I want to get your address, because in the finished version of the book, when you open the book, the end papers, they call them, the two that are usually blank, is filled with memorabilia from my childhood. And one of the pictures is a picture of Buddy Rich's autograph that I got from the piece of paper, and many other things, all the goals I wrote out when I was a kid that are on the cover of the book. So it's all these beautiful things of the stories that are in the book of the kids' dreams. Then at the end of the book are all the backstage passes and magazine covers and tour stuff of when the dream came to life. But we just bonded, and then that led to him inviting me to see him play at Disneyland, and I took Lenny Kravitz with me. And that's the night that Lenny got kicked out of his house and never moved back because we went to go see Buddy Rich. So there's these beautiful stories of these passionate boys that are just all about the music. It was incredible.
What a life you've lived. In 1985, you finally got your big break when you were hired as a drummer for New Edition. You said you went to the audition with a flame of generational vengeance burning in your soul, ready to unleash your fury. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, that goes back to all the hardships of Oregon, right? All of the generational vengeance. My grandfather was a Supreme Court justice in Mexico City. Had things gone right, my mother's life, she would have been a movie star, and all these things that should have come to us based on who we came from didn't happen. And so this was like I felt like my grandfather from the grave was like, "You are going to go there and show them that you are an East Los Bravo. You're going to show them the greatness run." Because everything that I learned about my grandfather, though I never met him, was that he was a man of excellence. He was a man of the people. He was like a Zorro. He was a Supreme Court justice who fought for the rights of people. He fought in the Mexican Revolutionary War. And so he was a social justice man, but he's a man who's gonna who if he was alive, he would have taught me how to be on the top, how to be that. Well, I learned it through my mother indirectly.
Oh, you learned it all right, I'll tell you. So there you were in 1985 playing with New Edition at a concert at Disney World in front of 80,000 fans. And only 5 years earlier, you auditioned at Disneyland with a band called the Romano Brothers, and you didn't get the job. Isn't it true that success is the best revenge?
It really is because it's like, and it's weird because when it happens, I almost feel like guilty that it's happened. It's almost like you spend your whole life wanting to show these people and wanting to get even. But then when you finally get there, you don't feel the same way. It's like, I don't want to make them feel bad. But when you were working towards it, that's your whole goal is to make those people eat crow, right? All the people who said you'd never amount to anything. But really, isn't that everyone's story? Like, my story is not unique in the sense that it's an overcoming story because that's the story of anybody in the world who's ever succeeded, right? Like
Well,
Lucille Ball.
not quite. Not quite. Your
Well, I
story, I've read hundreds of memoirs. We've done almost 400 shows. You
wow.
are absolutely not a typical success story. You've overcome far more obstacles than most people. And the way in which your success has manifested is really quite remarkable. Over the years, you got to play major concerts on stage in front of your mom, including one very special show in Las Vegas with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Frankie sang "Can't Take My Eyes Off of You" for your mom, and backstage he gave her a bouquet of roses. That must have been the gift of a lifetime for her and for you.
It was one of the most special nights of my life because, you know, all the other groups I played for were groups that were popular at that time, and they were the hot, you know, hot groups of the day. But playing with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons was someone my mother loved. So now I got a gig with somebody that she adored. And so that meant more to me than playing with another current pop star, you know, because that was something that, and it reminded me, and I made it very special because in the book, I talk about how she scrimped and saved and surprised us with the Frank Sinatra concert. Well, I did the same thing 10 years later, where I surprised her that I was the drummer with Frankie, but I never told her I had the gig. I told her I bought her tickets to go see him, like meaning I've got another gig in town that night somewhere else. And so when she gets there and the curtains open and she sees that I'm playing, she's like, you know, oh my God, my son's playing the gig. So it was one of the greatest joys of my life to surprise her like that. Frankie was just golden, and it treated me immensely beautiful. He also endorsed this book, by the way. Like, you probably had the arc of the book. I don't think you had the finished book. You probably had the arc, but the arc didn't have all the endorsements of the people. Like, Frankie endorsed it, Verdeen White from Earth, Wind & Fire, some of my idols, you know, and some of my writing idols. But that was a very, very, yeah, now that you mention it,
it your really success is anything but typical. Now, you've described your mother as part gentry, part gypsy. A part of her was broken by life, and a part of her was brimming with it. She was, in one sense, the tragic character in a fairy tale, and in another sense, she was the hero. How do you think she would react to your book?
She would be crying. She would be, gosh, I wish she could see it because, like, it's like I did it. You know, I mean,
well, does it give you comfort to know that you've immortalized your mother in your book and shared her with the whole world?
Yes. In fact, but just before it came out, the day before it came out, I told my brother Bobby, I said, tomorrow, we're going to make Mama famous. She wanted to be a famous actress. That was her dream. And she started, but she married the wrong guy and life got in the way. But I thought, you know what? Everyone and everyone who's read the book, like right now, there's like a, I think there's like 166 reviews on Amazon and they're all 5 stars. And everybody writes and they're like, your mother inspired me. Your family inspires me. You inspire, like, but so many people comment about Maria and go, she makes me want to be a better mother. She makes me not want to give up because the office of motherhood or fatherhood is the toughest gig in the world, no matter what the circumstances. And so I go, here, her life was not in vain. It was not wasted. She didn't get to become what she wanted to, but now she's becoming a heroic figure for people around the world of every race, creed, and color. And it's for something that is universal, motherhood, you know, the job of motherhood. And so it feels very special that, like, you know, and here's something interesting too, you know, like I've always dreamt of it as a movie. And for 20 years, I've told people, like, you know, Selma Hayek is the one who could play my mother. Selma Hayek is the one who could do it. Like, she looks like her. She's short, petite. She's from Mexico City like her. They have almost the same exact background. They both had aristocratic fathers. They were wealthy. And then the fathers died and they lost everything. And so I'm at Lenny's 60th birthday party. And who's there? He lets me know beforehand that she's going to be there because he's always known that I wanted to do this. And I get to meet Selma. And I give her sort of a soft pitch on the book and the story. And then I showed her the picture of my mother in the book that looks like her. And she was very, and one of the first things she asked me when I shared the book with her, I said something like, you know, I wear this scarf because my mother tied it around my neck when I was a boy and said that I would do something amazing with my life. Now, Selma had never met me, didn't know who I was. And then she goes, and have you? Have you done something amazing with your life? I said, yeah, in fact, I have. I became a world-renowned drummer. And then I told her who I played with and that I was Lenny's longtime friend and first drummer. And she goes, that's amazing. And she goes, and I said, my father left and, you know, my mother raised 7 children alone. And she goes, How many fathers, honey? How many fathers? I said, five. She goes, I love this woman already. She was a romantic. And I said, Selma, you are the first person that's ever said that. You are the first person that recognized that she was a romantic. She was in love with love, and she was in love with Hollywood and the movies, and she was always hoping to find that dream man, but never really did. And so I felt like she connected with it. And then there were other things we talked about three different times. And then I had the book already ready for her, and I had signed it to her. And I said, this woman you could play, this would be an Oscar-winning role because this is a great.
So maybe it's going to happen.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm as close as I've ever gotten. She has the book. Her and her husband
Okay,
have.
so now Tina Sinatra has the book. Selma Hayek has the book. Harvey Brownstone's pushing the book. I would
You're.
say that your mother is up there doing something.
She's doing something because it's like the fact that on this show that you told me that you read the passage to Tina Sinatra, you have, and the fact that the passage that you chose to read, it's so funny because I was with a group of guys creative guys, screenwriters and other writers, and I shared the book with them before it came out. And one guy's name is Tony Abrams. He read the Frank Sinatra chapter because he was fast. He loved Sinatra too. And he goes, your book has riveted me. He goes, this is incredible. He goes, now I want to read the whole thing. And he only had one of the whole entire book. He said, do you want to hear my only one critique? I'm like, yeah. He goes, in the Sinatra chapter, he goes, it's amazing. The whole thing moved me and it was riveting. He goes, but I just wanted to hear one thing. I wanted to hear from that 12-year-old kid what Sinatra did to you when you watched him. And that's where I came up with the sentence, the paragraph that you read that moved you was because he wanted me to go deeper on what I was emotionally feeling because he's a screenwriter. And after I thought about it, I came up with that paragraph. And when I read it to him, he goes, now I've got the chills. Now my hair is standing. And it made Tina cry. So I
Well,
can't.
it really made Tina cry because you were able to articulate exactly what the emotional impact of her father's voice was,
Yes.
but most particularly on a child. Frank
Yes.
Sinatra very much wanted to be a vocalist for the generations. And
Yes.
when he saw young people in his audiences, he was extremely happy because he wanted his music to live on. He wanted young people to appreciate him, even though he wasn't considered a young person's favorite singer, but
Right.
he was yours. So that's what
Yes.
really got to her. Well, Zorro, I have only one more question for you, and it's this. In your book, you described the taste of home as your mama's Velveeta macaroni and cheese casserole and a Betty Crocker yellow cake with chocolate frosting. Do you ever eat those things now just out of nostalgia?
I have not in a long, long, long time. I was always trying to figure out how to get the recipe of her Velveeta macaroni and cheese thing, because my wife's an extraordinary cook, Renee, and I can never find the one that kind of feels like that. It was very cheesy and like that. It was almost like baked on, and it was stringy. Once in a while, it has been a long time. Maybe I'll ask for that for my 62nd birthday. Is the yellow cake with the chocolate frosting? I think any time I have had it, which hasn't been many times. In fact, I'm going to think for my birthday this year. I think that's what I'm going to want. I think you just inspired me to go. That's what I want for my birthday. I want some
Okay, that's
as
what
close
you
as
need
I
to
can.
do. Every time I eat macaroni and cheese, I think of you. And that's the cake I want for my birthday because I want to honor your mom. Oh, my dear Zorro, I want to thank you so much for sharing your amazing mother with all of us, your deeply moving life story through this unforgettable book. And most of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
This, okay, I'm sending an email to my publicist right after this. And maybe as soon as we're done hanging up, we could talk for a second after we're done with the show. But what I want to say to all the people watching is this was the best interview I've ever done. This was the deepest, most heartfelt. You are the best interviewer I've ever had. I've done hundreds of interviews in my lifetime in 40 some years in the music industry. I've done thousands of interviews, all kinds, TV, podcasts, radio. This was my favorite interview. We could have talked for 10 hours. You are gifted at what you do. You have a deep, rich knowledge. You've got an incredible heart. This was an honor and a privilege. And just the bonus of the Tina Sinatra thing took this from what was already 100 to, if you can go to 1,000. You know, like, you are awesome, Harvey. And this interview is my absolute favorite I've ever done. And you were just a blessing to humanity for what you're able to pull out of people and the heart you carry.
Well, Zorro, you've touched me profoundly, and I appreciate it so much. I feel like I made a new friend, and I'm so, so grateful to have you on the show. And when that movie comes out, promise me you'll come back to promote it.
Oh, that's a definite. You're going to be the first on the list. I'm like, I'm not doing anything but the Harvey Brownstein show. That's the only one that matters to me.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been the world-renowned drummer, educator, motivational speaker, and author, Zorro, whose new book, Maria's Scarf, a memoir of a mother's love, a son's perseverance, and dreaming big, is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. You can learn more about Zorro and the book by going to his official website, ZorroTheDrummer.com. And you can learn more about Zorro's work as an inspirational and motivational speaker by going to the website, ZorroMinistries.org. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.